This is MuggleCast, Episode 4, for August 28th, 2005. That's right, there are spoilers. Hey everybody, welcome to Episode 4 of MuggleCast. We're joined this week by me, Andrew Sims.
I'm Ben Shane.
I'm Jamie Lawrence.
And I'm still Eric Skull.
Let's get things started by first taking a look at the past week's top stories with Micah.
Thanks, Andrew. Let's begin with our top news story. Start spreading the news. Don't worry, I won't break out singing Frank Sinatra, but Warner Brothers announced Friday that the Big Apple will host the U.S. premiere of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire on November 12, 2005. The world premiere will take place a week earlier, on November 6th, in London. Speaking of Goblet of Fire, on Wednesday, Warner Brothers officially released the international trailer with amazing shots of the Quidditch World Cup and all three tasks in the Triwizard Tournament. Listeners can check out this new trailer by logging on to the film's official website at www.gobletoffire.com. Staying with the topic of movie premieres, Katie Leung, who portrays Cho Chang, and Robert Pattinson, who portrays Cedric Diggory, both recently attended the Dukes of Hazzard premiere in Leicester Square, London. Hopefully, they weren't taking any acting lessons. Finally, wrapping up our movie news for this week, Tom Felton, who portrays Draco Malfoy, will supposedly stay on through the filming of the seventh Harry Potter movie. He spoke about it while hosting the third annual Junior Carp Tournament, saying, "I'll keep doing it as long as they want me to." In other news, a Dutch Harry Potter fan named Dennis just couldn't wait for the release of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, so he made his own rendition, entitled Harry Potter and the Torch with Green Flames, which he started writing back in January of 2004. And while publishing of his creation was forbidden, it was uploaded onto the internet, in Dutch for those of you who wish to read. Moving from the Netherlands to France, the French cover of Half-Blood Prince was released on Tuesday, which is similar in style to the American Deluxe Edition. The book is due out in France on October 1st. Finally, if you didn't have a chance to participate, on Thursday, MuggleNet staffer Jamie Lawrence hosted a chat with Matthew Lewis, who portrays Neville Longbottom. You can log on to MuggleNet.com to check out the transcript. And before we leave, two birthday announcements to make. One to Rupert Grint, the actor who portrays Ron Weasley in the Harry Potter films, turned 17, and to MuggleNet senior staffer Ben Shane, who turned 16, both on Tuesday. Happy birthday to both of you, and I'd sing happy birthday, but I assume you want to keep your ratings up. You can get more in-depth news, pictures, videos, and audio clips of all the things mentioned by logging on to MuggleNet.com. That's all the news for this August 28th, 2005 edition of MuggleCast. Back to you guys.
All right, thanks, Micah, and also a big thanks to him for doing all of our transcripts. He's been transcribing each episode for you guys, so in case you want to go back, look over it, or just read it instead of listen. It's a big help. Thanks again, Micah. Guys, I have some excellent news. We have our first... We actually have a use, and I have proof. Because Eric Nelson, a sixth grade teacher at the school that he teaches, he is going to use our show for to illustrate how literature discussions should go and how they can be enjoyable.
How they should go?
Yeah, like, he's going to use our show to teach his class.
Well, that's awesome. Awesome. Hello, class of... Wait, what's his name?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Nelson. Hello, Mr. Nelson's class.
You. Yeah, you. You in the front. Keep quiet.
Oh.
Okay.
That's me. All right,
so I think that's really cool. And I think... we want to know how you guys are listening to our show.
Oh, yes.
So, like, send us an email. It's pretty fun, because, like, some people listen to it before school.
And on their way to school, even.
On the way to school.
Yeah, on the way to school. There was that person who commented that they do it on their way to school.
On their iPods, yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, so people take us everywhere.
We are honored.
It's cool.
Should be MuggleCast everywhere. Like, every household in America and across the world in Great Britain.
Yeah, so we're pretty much just taking over the world. So let us know how you listen to the show. Email us, mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com. All right, before we get to our main discussion topics and voicemails of the week, we've a pretty big announcement. Right, Eric?
That's right, Andrew.
Well, why don't you tell us what it's all about?
All righty, then. Okay. Those truly dedicated slash bored fans out there will remember that back in episode 3 of MuggleCast, Ben had shared a funny thought with us about how Lord Voldemort could be killed without a wand once he was mortal again in Book 7. He said that it would be quite funny if Harry had pulled on some earmuffs and pulled out a mandrake, causing Voldemort to die instantly upon hearing its cry. I found this funny mostly because of its, like, it's got this high improbability, yet, you know, it'll definitely be effective, you know, if it did actually happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Ben's comment was met with many laughs, and in reply I said that it would be funny if we had a list, much like our 100 Ways to Annoy Lord Voldemort, which would state possible ways for him to be killed that were just as obscure or unlikely as a Mandrake song.
And sure enough, as we should have expected, the suggestion brought about instantaneous emails flooding our inboxes with fan ideas.
Instantaneous!
Yes, on how to kill Voldemort that most likely wouldn't happen in the books. Because of this tremendous response that we had here at MuggleNet, we decided to form the first official exclusive competition.
Wait!
What? What?
Drum roll! Boom!
I guess I'll do it. MuggleCast's Funny Ways Voldemort Won't Die Contest.
Yes, that's correct. We are welcoming fans to send in their ideas on how they'd like to see the Dark Lord taken care of that are very unlikely but just as effective as the next suggestion. Upon receiving all the entries, a list will be created that will go on MuggleNet in the near future. Not just that, but the top 20 winners as chosen by the MuggleCast staff will be posted separately for a short period of time, and MuggleNet fans will be able to vote on their favorites. Then, at a preset time, the top 3 choices will be listed and numbered respectively, and their entrants will be awarded a prize.
So, if you've already sent emails with some suggestions on improbable ways to get rid of them, do not worry, Eric.
Don't worry. Your
email and suggestions have been saved, and we will read them and take them into account for acceptance. If you have not entered, you're more than welcome to by using our contact us form on the MuggleCast section of the site, though we ask that you do please be sure to include your name and email address or some way to contact you if you have won. And we do ask that you send only one, your favorite entry, to us. This is important because we know we're going to be getting a lot of entries, and just take your time and think out one really good one.
This is our way of keeping the numbers low, C, because, you know, we at MuggleCast have enough to do with planning and receiving all the topic suggestions and voice message questions and just broadcasting the show as is, that we can't possibly sort through dozens of entries by the same person. The only exception to that rule is what we're going to do now.
A very dedicated fan named Sydney sent us a list of 101 ways to improbably kill or otherwise annoy Voldemort. Because of the nature of the contest, we only paid attention to those that improbably killed him and have these top 7 choices to offer you as examples of what we are looking for.
Number 1, example for a way that Voldemort could improbably be killed, throw him to the crazed fangirls. Number 2, bewitch him to work out to Buns of Steel. Number 3, have Dudley sit on him. Number 4, make a Voldemort voodoo doll and put it through the washing machine. Example number 5, make him listen to Lockhart talk about himself for the rest of forever. Okay. And number 7, Andrew, would you like to do the honors? Example number 7 for how to improbably kill Voldemort.
Feed a McDonald's for a year.
That's right. Bum. Boom. Ooh.
Doorbell.
As you can see, each choice presents a sort of edge to the parameters of what we're looking for, and we'll look for the same creative edge when judging. Right, Andrew?
That's right, Eric.
Now, if you'd like to enter the contest through email and not our contact form, which I don't know why they'd want to do that, you know, at all. You can send all entries to voldemort@staff.mugglenet.com. Isn't that a funny email address? I thought so too.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's cool because, well, Voldemort works here now. So, anyway, we think that should be it, and we will announce the end date for the competition as well as those that made the list sometime in the near future. Three. Good luck, fans!
In case you guys haven't noticed, this last week, we were up at the top of iTunes, and then we sort of got knocked off completely of iTunes, and I'd like everyone, just a reminder, if you want to know what happened with that, in case you haven't already listened to it, you can listen to the special edition of MuggleCast and
Which,
Pottercast.
By the way, which by the way, was fabulous. I thought it definitely had a lot of direction to it, more so than the Forbidden episode, which we recorded the night before.
Right,
that.
We were joined by Melissa Anelli from Pottercast, which is the Leaky Cauldrons.
Right.
Similar name to podcast, and yeah, maybe sometime we'll have her on the show sometime. But yeah, so those of you who haven't listened to it yet, go ahead and take a peek at it. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and while you're at it, subscribe to us
10
on
times.
iTunes.
I'm kidding. Okay. Do not yeah. Click subscribe more than once. Oh, actually it doesn't matter because iTunes fixed the hack in the music store. So go ahead if you feel like clicking subscribe a bunch of times. Go ahead because it's not going to do anything like it used to.
Yeah.
Oh, and for those of you, the current Emerson status report, Emerson is in the shower right now, so
in the shower?
No. No, it's a away message. It says he's in the shower, so if you guys want to take a stop by Emerson's dorm.
So that's our new feature, one of the new features here on MuggleCast. We're going to
Where is Emerson?
Well, yeah, we're going to let you know where Emerson is. You can only find this here. EmersonSparts.net. Well, they got some good info. They don't have what we have. Okay.
We have insider information. Insider information.
Yeah, we got the goods. So moving on to the main discussion of the week, my fellow MuggleCasters, Ralph Fiennes. Is he good for the role of Lord Voldemort in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire? Ben Shane?
Have we even seen any pictures of him?
No, we haven't.
Okay, so we haven't seen any pictures of this guy as Voldemort, so we don't even know.
Well, we've kind of seen the face he makes. We've seen that face on
Regis.
Yeah, but they're saving like the Lord Voldemort pictures. Like, I guess I don't know if there's even going to be any before the movie's actually released. So,
I don't know. Maybe a trailer.
Yeah, that seems to be
one guy that they're keeping under wraps has been him.
Obviously, they thought him good enough, you know.
Obviously,
that's cool. I mean, well, that's cool. I mean, whether or not he's, I don't know.
Yeah, but they've messed up some characters in the past. Mark Williams, who plays Arthur Weasley in the first three movies, he was supposed to be tall and skinny and balding, and he's not exactly that. But I think he does an excellent job as portraying the actor.
And Harry's supposed to have green eyes, too.
So I think that whoever WB ended up choosing for the role is still going to be very good. So I don't think we have anything to worry about. Jamie, do you have something to say? Might?
Yeah, man, I do, yeah. The thing about Voldemort is he's a completely different character to everyone else. I mean, whereas it's still a book, the entire thing's still a book, you can picture Harry, Hermione, Ron more easily than you can picture Voldemort. And because he's the bad character, you know, it conjures up images of monsters in the dark and things like that. And it's extremely hard to picture him. So I think Warner Brothers are going to have to present him as some kind of monster-type figure, you know, the object of people's nightmares. But it's going to be very interesting to see how they do him.
I mean, we didn't even get a real look at him in Sorcerer's Stone, because I don't know who that guy was played by. But, I think that's this is going to be one of the parts of Goblet of Fire that they're going to really try to hype up. Because he hasn't been seen in the trailers, and I doubt he will be in the full trailer.
Okay, well, one of the things about the movies also is, as you were kind of getting to, is that they're kind of reinventing him every single film. You know, we've seen Christian Coulson as the young Tom Riddle, and now we're going to see Ralph Fiennes as the Voldemort in Goblet of Fire. So we're kind of seeing all different, you know, ages for Voldemort, and it's going to be kind of cool, especially in movie 6, if the whole background story of Tom Riddle, how many different Riddles they're going to cast, and if, you know, Ralph will be in this scene where he comes back to Dumbledore asking to be a teacher, and if they'll use Christian again, you know, that'll be cool to see.
Yeah, that's definitely, that's an interesting point, because he hasn't been signed on, you know, they've been, especially like the Internet Movie Database, IMDb.com, they usually have some inside info, but Ralph hasn't been announced yet.
Yeah, but like, as we get into the movie six, do you think we might see Christian come back and do like the Horcrux scenes going back in time, sort of like we saw in the second movie?
I think that would be great.
Because,
keep the consistency throughout the entire set of movies. I think it would be good if we kept the entire, set of actors throughout the entire series. You know, there was one exception, which is the death of Dumbledore. The guy, Richard Harris, who played Dumbledore in the first two movies, and then we had to see Michael Gambon, who also does an excellent job, take over for him. But if nothing like that happens, if there's no other tragedies like that, I think it would be great if we saw the same characters hold throughout the rest of the series of the movies.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm very happy that they kept, you know, Matt Lewis and Dean and Seamus and all that throughout the movies. Even if they don't have, you know, the biggest roles, they're still there in the background, which kind of in itself keeps consistency. And I think one of the things that Alfonso did that I liked was make Hogwarts sort of a multi-ethnic and multicultural as well, more so than the first two movies did, and which is cool. And I was glad that they kept the main characters, you know, as well through that transition. So then Goblet of Fire, what we've seen from the stills is that it's still this, you know, the same way, and it's really good.
Eric, do you have something else to say about that?
No, I'm done.
Okay. Ben, Ben.
Eric,
keep that in there.
I'm bad. I'm
Eric,
evil.
Eric, stop talking now. It's Eric's turn, okay? Then Eric, okay? After Eric, we've got Eric.
All right, the story behind this was I did talk, and I did notice this, is that I talked quite a little bit more than I probably should have in episode 3, so I apologize. To anybody who thought that I talked too much, I apologize.
No, people like to.
We love you, Eric, next.
Okay, so anyway. That's another discussion that could easily be a big topic to talk about, which would be the rest of the actors. Are they going to stay on through movie 7? Dan Radcliffe, Emma Watson, Rupert Grint.
Rupert signed up for 5.
Most of them. Most of them have been signed on for Order of the Phoenix by now, but Eric?
Hey. Hey, get Jamie to talk.
I thought you had something to say.
No, I have nothing to say.
Ask Eric. It's Eric's turn.
Okay. Okay. I'm mute. I.
Yeah, so if any of the actors are listening to this, Emma, I would just like to... clarify.
Oh, no,
Ben.
You don't get to talk to Emma.
Yeah, so...
You don't get to talk to Emma. You can't just address
Eric,
Emma like
Eric,
that.
Eric, Ben... Ben,
I believe it
Ben
was my
has
turn
a tiny
to
crush.
Hey, Emma.
Ben has a tiny crush on Emma.
Just a tiny. Aww, just a
little.
Don't you as well, Jamie? Don't you as well, Jamie?
It's nothing compared to other people.
That's okay.
Hey.
Yeah,
hey.
I get emails from Emma Watson lover 01 all the time.
Who's that?
No, I'm not talking about her or him.
Next topic, please.
Tell me. This is interesting.
Who we won't mention? No, I can't say. I'll say after the show. Big part of this movie is the special effects. Now, there's been a lot of them in Prisoner of Azkaban and Chamber of Secrets, Sorcerer's Stone, but there's going to be a lot more in this movie because of the Triwizard Tournament, as well as everything that goes on, especially like Voldemort's appearance. And because Jamie brought this up to me earlier today. You have anything else to say about that, Jamie?
I was going to say this film, you know, especially as you said, the Triwizard Tournament. It is a very special tournament. It's a very elaborate tournament. It's very, and I think that it's going to
only one will go down in history. Only one will reach eternal glory.
Exactly what I was going to say. Anyway, before Ben brilliantly interrupted me, the fourth book, especially with the Triwizard Tournament, the entire thing needs a lot of special effects to work out, because I mean, the second task, half of it is going to be filmed underwater, and with the Gillyweed or Gillyweed, however you pronounce it.
Gillyweed.
Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Sorry, someone else go.
You always do this, I swear.
I can't. I lose... it's not only me. Eric, didn't you have something to say?
We're bad. We're terrible.
Yes,
we're
I've got something to say. No, I can say
go.
Something. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was... obviously just came out, you know, very recently, and it does have a lot of special effects in it also, and maybe not as much as Goblet of Fire, but I thought that was a movie where they had quite a lot of special effects, and they blended them nicely with real life.
Yeah, that's a good point. Almost that whole movie was special effects,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, and it can
I
be.
I mean, including those Oompa Loompas, they didn't have 2,000 of them in one room.
Right.
There was just each one.
It was one guy. It was, you know, Deep Roy. So I
so
thought
really,
that was quite well done.
Yeah, and it really didn't look like one. It didn't look fake or all. Tim Burton, who directed that film, did an excellent job.
Now back to Harry Potter. About Goblet of Fire, I think that. Personally, I feel that I trust WB and that some people were scared, like Christopher Columbus said in his interview on the Chamber of Secrets DVD, that he was worried, no, Steve Kloves, excuse me, said that he was worried about the giant spider scene and how fake and how humorous that was going to look when it was supposed to be scary. But in the end, it turned out to actually look pretty cool. It actually was kind of frightening for the smaller children and things and kids of the younger ages. So I feel I have my faith in WB. I think that they're going to turn out another excellent movie based on what we've seen, the special effects and things that we've seen in the trailer so far. I don't think there will really be a problem
like
with it, and that it's not going to take away from the movie at all.
Yeah. And we're forgetting that everybody, you know, everybody's gotten better at acting, all the trio and everybody. You know, they've
yeah.
just gotten better.
Jamie?
Lawrence, do you have something to say?
Thanks, man. Yeah, I do, yeah. Do you think it's a case of all films in the 21st century using more special effects just because, you know, it's computers catching up with the film world? Or do you think it's just the Harry Potter series that needs that sort of injection of... special effects to make it more
brilliant
fantasy.
Brilliant idea, Jamie. No, yeah, I think it's all movies. Maybe more so than others. The only point I was bringing up with Charlie and Chuck Factory is that we've seen it can be done. You know, a blend can be made. And yeah, I have faith in WB also. I think it'll be fine.
Okay, we've sort of lost our host. Hold on. Andrew fell out.
Andrew fell
yeah,
out.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, we just finished the special effects topic. On August 23rd, we saw the second book released in the Inheritance trilogy, Eldest, which is the successor to Aragorn. And earlier this week, we sat down with Andrew. Actually, sat down with Eldest webmaster dude Mike from Shirtoogle.com, where we interviewed him about the book and we saw what his thoughts are about another fantasy book that many of you might enjoy.
All right, so we're joined by Mike McCauley of Shirtoogle.com. Shirtoogle.com is a website based on the Inheritance trilogy. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing pretty good. You?
I'm doing good, thanks. So we brought you on here today because we need to break some news to all these Harry Potter fans. Harry Potter is not the only good fantasy series out there, right?
Right.
Right. Okay. So we brought you on to ask you a couple questions because your site is basically the MuggleNet of the Inheritance trilogy.
You could say that.
Yeah, you could. You went to the premiere of the new book. You've gotten pre-release copies. Random House loves you. It's just like you're in a good place right now. So give our listeners a general overview of the Inheritance trilogy.
Well, Aragorn tells the tale of a poor farm boy who's ironically named Aragorn, and he finds a blue stone when he's hunting in the nearby mountains, and the stone ends up hatching, and it ends up being a dragon's egg, and Aragorn bonds with his dragon, who he names Saphira, and when his uncle Garrow is killed by agents of the Empire, he sets out on this adventure to avenge his uncle's death, and realizes that he has to take sides with either the Empire or the Varden, which is the rebel group trying to overthrow the Empire. And the book pretty much tells the tale of Aragorn's struggles, and he's plagued by many deaths and, you know, things that just obstacles that get in his way. And it's a good book, so if you want to know more, I'd suggest reading it.
We're checking out your site. So this is definitely a series that would appeal to a Harry Potter fan.
Yeah, I'd say that.
So tell us the story about the author, Christopher. He wrote the first book when he was just 15.
Yeah, Christopher Paolini is... as you said, he wrote the story when he was 15 years old. It actually took him 2 years because when he wrote it the first time, after his family went through and edited it, he... took a look at it and pretty much realized that it needed to be rewritten. So he spent another year rewriting it, and his family, who published books before, mainly educational books, decided that they were going to give up everything they were doing, and they realized the book had potential, so they self-published. And for a few years, they, you know, they toured the U.S. trying to promote the book and sell the book wherever they could. And Chris Chur is going to hate me for saying this, but he used to tour in this red swordsman shirt and these black, as he calls them, pantaloons, and pretty funny outfit, trying to promote his book. And when they were on tour, they got a call from Random House, who offered them a book deal. And that was a pretty big break, considering all the work they had been doing just to get the book out there.
Right.
And, yeah.
So how did Random House pick up this series?
Well, Carl Hiaasen, who's a popular author, he wrote the book Hoot, among many others. And him and his stepson, Ryan Hiaasen, were out, they were fly fishing in Montana. And Ryan picked up a copy, one of the self-published copies of Aragon, at one of the local bookstores and read it and loved it. And he told his father about it, and his father told Random House, and Random House realized the book had potential, and it all went from there.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So when, I'm not sure if you know this, so when Chris got this news in his family, how did they react?
Well, I mean, I'd imagine that they were overwhelmed with surprise, because, I mean, that's a huge break. And, of course, they had to find an agent, and they worked out all the details, and pretty soon Aragon was published by Random House.
So tell us about the Eldest premiere. The book just came out a few days ago.
Yep, that released on Tuesday, August 23rd. I went into New York City for the book release, where Christopher was kicking off his book tour at Barnes & Noble in Union Square. And I was there on the 22nd, too. We did lunch, dinner. I went to Random House. It's really an amazing place. And then the next day, I got a chance to intern at Random House. I helped distribute promotional items for his book tour.
Wow.
And when we headed down to Union Square, and none of us knew what to expect, because it's a city and not the easiest place to get to, but there was well over 900 fans, or no, I'd say around 700 to 900 fans. Christopher made a presentation, and Gerard Doyle, the narrator for the audiobook, did a reading, and then Christopher signed 700 or more copies of his book, which must have been amazing.
700?
Well, yeah, 700.
Wow. Oh, it was basically a big book signing? Or?
I'd say so. Towards the end of the book signing, actually, when everyone was finished, I went up to get my copy signed, and I looked down at his hand, which was, one side was purple, looked bruised, and the other side was bright red.
Wow.
And when I ever walked up to him with around 35 copies of the book to be signed, the glare was enough to, if looks could kill.
If looks could kill, you would certainly be dead.
Yes.
So, and then, the book was released on the 23rd, and then, wouldn't you know it, Eldest actually beat Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince on Amazon's top list of top-selling books.
It sure did.
And it's worth noting that Harry Potter is actually pushed down to number 3. Eldest is at number 1. And then a book titled Why Do Men Have Nipples is at number 2. And I guess Oprah promoted it or something, or I don't know what happened. But so we'll see what happens with that. But tell us about the website, shirtugel.com.
Well, I started the site back in December 2003. About 2 months after the book was released, and back then I was getting about 25 visitors a day, and I knew no one from the Paolini family, I knew no one from Random House, and I've been hard at work for the past close to 2 years now, and I've built connections, and I talk with the Paolini family, who are a huge help for my website. Without them, I don't think the site would be anywhere, and Random House, who obviously just invited me into the city for the book release. So it's been amazing.
All right, so that's about it. Mike, thanks for joining us, and we hope people will check out the book. And once again, guys, you know, there's definitely some other books, good books besides Harry Potter. The Inheritance Trilogy is definitely one of them. Thanks, Mike.
Yep, no problems. Thanks for having me.
All right, so that was my interview with Mike McCauley. Once again, that's SureTugal.com, SHURTUGAL.com. All right, now let's move on to our favorite part of the show, the voicemails. Woo! I love these because you guys keep sending in so many, and most of them are good. Okay, I want to start off this part of the show with a nice voicemail we got from this one kid. You guys definitely have to take a listen to this. This is a classic.
Hello, this is Yoda from the MuggleNet chat room. And I have a very, 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 very basic question. Who do you think is R.A.B. in the sixth book? And thank you, and may the force be with you. I'm so alone. This sucks.
What did he say there at the end?
He said, I'm so alone. This sucks. Yoda, I thank you for your question. It was probably one of the best ones we received, just for the originality. We've already answered this question before, who is R.A.B.? But do you guys want to talk about it?
No, I don't think
more?
It's necessary. We've pretty much came to the consensus that it's Regulus Black, and we have about 55,000 trillion billion other voicemails to get to.
Here's something. Okay, wait a second. Here's something I found out interesting, though. I was reading MongoNet's world-famous editorials, and I came across one that points out, okay, R-A-B, if you shift each letter forward, S-B-C, Sirius Black's cousin.
Wow.
What do you think of that?
Okay, and Dribble's best blowing gum is gold under St. Mungo's and about 1,000 other acronyms.
No, but isn't that
that's
cool?
Not even an acronym, but
today.
Yeah.
Free.
It's interesting, but it is probably just coincidence, though.
This one theory pointed out that it was one of Sirius Black's.
You guys
cousins.
Are so not HP sleuths. I swear, you guys need to read Galadriel Waters' books. And there's no such
okay,
thing
now listen,
as a coincidence.
Wait a second. You don't have to read Galadriel Waters' books just to nail your HP
no,
stuff.
I'm just saying that there's no such thing as a coincidence. It's one of the five rules of being an HP sleuth. Right, Eric?
That isn't true, though. That's
no,
not true.
No,
of course
no.
There are.
There are such things as coincidences.
No, there's a difference. There's a difference between there's a difference between being a coincidence and going way too far, and you know that's just the only time
the first book's called,
I don't know, I just think that's kind of interesting.
The first book's called Harry Potter, and so is the fifth book. That is coincidence.
It is.
What? Huh? What did you say?
I said the first book's called Harry Potter, and the fifth book's called Harry Potter. Now that is a coincidence, you know. I think they could be part
Jamie?
Of the same series, you know? They could be.
Jamie.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was Jamie's British joke of the day.
Thank you very much.
Now let's move on to more voicemails. All right, now this next one comes from Elon.
Hey, MuggleCast. First of all, I want to tell you that I really like your show. Now here's my question. When Snape performs the Avada Kedavra curse on Dumbledore at the end of Book 6... why does he fly into the air when we see in Book 4 regarding Frank Bryce and Cedric Diggory that they just crumple to the floor? Does this mean that Snape actually did not perform an authentic killing curse?
Book 6, Snape conjures a killing curse, but Dumbledore flies up into the air. Compared to Book 4 when Cedric Diggory just collapses to the ground. What is going on, Eric?
Well, it's definitely a lot of questions about Dumbledore's death. You know, he flew, you know, when, well, Dumbledore himself says there's no mark, the death curse leaves no mark. We've seen it before at the very beginning of Goblet of Fire with the Riddle's death. You know, there was nothing wrong with them except that they were dead. And it's the same thing throughout the books. So, yes, Dumbledore's flying into the air and over the balcony is quite suspicious, and, you know, we can treat it as such. I don't know what it means, really. I think Dumbledore is dead, but that's a good question. It's to speculate, really.
I think Dumbledore is dead, but I don't know why he flew out the thing. I'd say it's either just for show, you know, because he was such an important character, and Joe really had to, you know, make it clear that he was dead, or because he's so powerful. Because Cedric, you know, he was still at school, and he didn't have the power that Dumbledore had. So after Snape killed Dumbledore, you know, he had so much magical power filled within him that it was all, you know, just expulsed. All of his power was just released from him, and he flew backwards over the battlements.
Well, I think the reason that Dumbledore flew up in the air is because I'm one of those people that thinks that Snape did it killed Dumbledore on Dumbledore's orders. And I think that the real reason that Dumbledore flew up into the air is because Snape felt so guilty about it, and he had all this hatred built up against Dumbledore for Dumbledore making him do this, that when he performed the curse, that it sent him sailing up into the air, that it was all this emotion that was built up, and just, you know, it all flew into Dumbledore, and then that's why Dumbledore flew up in the air. I think that makes the most sense, that it was just emotion and everything built up that led to him skyrocketing.
Yeah, I agree with Ben, because, you know, there's, once again, a lot of people think, oh, Dumbledore didn't die, this is just one of the reasons why. But really, it could have just been the way that Snape conjured it. Jamie.
The second part of that voicemail asked whether Snape performed an authentic killing curse, and I think we should talk about that, because that's quite an interesting point. But, I mean, throughout the book, you know, a great deal of emphasis has been laid on the fact that the unforgivable curses really are powerful, and it takes a great wizard to conjure them. And I don't really think it's feasible that you could, you know, perform the Avada Kedavra curse. You know, the green light comes out of your wand and somebody dies, but it's only like a half-wanted curse. I think your entire heart has to be in it. Whether you want it because you do actually want the person dead and you've been ordered to, or because the person who's going to die ordered you to do it.
Yeah, so it's possible he still did mean it, even if he was a good
guy. That's what we're
saying. All right, this next one is from Stasia.
Hi, guys. This is Stasia. I listen to MuggleCast from Wisconsin, and I'm 39. My question for you is, why did Harry leave his invisibility cloak on top of the tower after Dumbledore was murdered? Wouldn't it have made more sense for him to be invisible while chasing Snape and Draco? Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Well, personally, what I think the problem is, like, the reason that Harry left it at the top of the tower is because that when he was so built up with emotion, he just saw Dumbledore being murdered, that it really wasn't an issue. He wasn't thinking. Like, his wits were not about him. He just thought, okay, I'm going to chase right after him, you know, because he didn't think, oh, I should be invisible, then chase after him. He just thought, I'm running, you know, these people just killed the headmaster of Hogwarts, the head of the Order of the Phoenix. This is the only choice I have.
As Ben said, no, I think that's definitely the main reason that he did that. You know, he could finally move his limbs and you know, chase after Snape, and I think he was just worried about that. There's two other things, though. One of them is it probably wouldn't have been that smart if Harry had actually put on his invisibility cloak, because, you know, I would relate it to driving a car, because it's not good to be invisible if you're driving a car, because all the other cars, the way they move is, it's judging on if they can see you and how fast. Basically, if Harry had his invisibility cloak on and he was running through, you know, the whole battle scene, and everybody was looking for a place to run to dodge an attack, they could have, you know, jumped right into him and not seen him. You know, it just wouldn't have been a good idea if he had his invisibility cloak on in the middle of that. You know, a curse could have hit him easily, and, you know, I think it's... Basically, it wouldn't have been a good idea if he had it on. The only time he'd be able to use it would be after he's chasing after Snape all the way out in the grounds.
I didn't think about that, maybe accidentally getting hit, but I just thought maybe he did it because he didn't want to hide and sort of be... He didn't want to cower. He just wanted to run after them.
Well,
like Harry Potter
would. Right, and we've seen Harry... Yeah, we've seen Harry disregard stealth before, or not fully appreciate, you know, its ability. Like, even though he does use the invisibility cloak often, in book 3 in Prisoner of Azkaban, when they're in the time turner, he's so concerned with just finding his dad that he doesn't care if he's seen or anything. He's bent on seeing Prongs. And also, one really cool thing, I'm sorry, I don't want to, you know, talk too long, but in book 1, I was just rereading, and in book 1 there's a brilliant parallel, which I think Jamie would be proud of, but book 1, Harry leaves his invisibility cloak on top of the tower after they return Norbert to Charlie, and it's really interesting because it's the North Tower, and he left his invisibility cloak off there, and who returns it to him but Dumbledore? And just hours before, Draco was up on the North Tower. So it's really this scene where Draco was there and Harry was there and he left his invisibility cloak and Dumbledore, you know, was connected. It's just a really cool parallel, I thought.
That's good enough. I like that. But I was going to say about book 6 when he does that. I agree with, I think it was Andrew, that it's just a case that he was so angry at Dumbledore being dead that he just completely forgot it. But also, He had to run to catch up with Snape because they had a head start on him. And if you're running flat out, the invisibility cloak, you know, is going to flap up and it isn't going to cover your feet. So it would have really been pointless anyway.
Yeah, so basically what we're trying to say is that it just wouldn't work. Okay, this next one is from Michelle.
Hi, MuggleCast guys. I'd like to propose the idea that the item of Godric Gryffindor's that Voldemort used as one of his Horcruxes was, as Dumbledore said, not the Sword of Gryffindor, but instead the Sorting Hat. I think this makes sense, as the Sorting Hat is an item of great magical power and prestige, both qualities Voldemort was looking for in potential Horcruxes, as well as the hat having such a powerful influence at Hogwarts. Given that the Sorting Hat almost has a mind of its own, it could also prove very difficult to destroy. What are your thoughts on this?
I just had an idea that Slytherin, the house, is like, you know, you could class them as dark wizard followers because Hagrid said that, you know, there wasn't a wizard in Slytherin who hadn't gone bad. So I was going to say that perhaps he had sort of used the Sorting Hat for one reason, to like handpick the people who he could pick to follow him as his Death Eaters. But then the Sorting Hat was there a long while before Voldemort, so I don't think he could do that. But I think it would really attract him because, you know, it's right under Dumbledore's nose. It's at the centre of Hogwarts. It is a thing of massive magical power. And I think he'd be really pleased to have that as a Horcrux. But then the problem still remains of how does he actually get into Hogwarts, get into Dumbledore's office, get the Sorting Hat and kill somebody to turn it into a Horcrux all in a day's work.
And also, why couldn't he just, like, bewitch the Sorting Hat so that when Harry Potter sits down that it gobbles
it kills
him
or something, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you guys have made it, like, range into this wide variety of things. It brings into question how to make a Horcrux, if you have to kill somebody and make it right there.
Yeah.
Or if you, you know, I've seen it speculated that when Voldemort twitches his wand in Dumbledore's office or whatever, I've seen it, like, speculated that that's when he makes a Sorting Hat or whatever, a Horcrux. But really, I think that was just because, just going to show that he's, you know, tensing up and about to attack Dumbledore. So I think that's that. But, no, it's another question is, like, would Dumbledore, could that honestly have gone unnoticed? And, you know, could the Sorting Hat hide that? And I think, as Jamie said, it's an element of massive magical power, so he'd obviously want that as a Horcrux, and I think that's a cool idea. Andrew?
Okay.
What do you think?
I have nothing else to say to that, because I think you guys covered it.
Okay,
this next one is from Tom.
Hi, guys. I'm a huge fan of the show. My name is Tom from Indiana. I was just wondering, because you guys haven't said on the show before, I've read the first book 50 times and all the other books, excluding the fifth one, 20-plus times. And I was just wondering, how many times have you guys read the books?
Hold it, moly. He's read book one 50
times. 50 times?
Yeah, and then the rest of... I wonder if he's talking about Half-Blood Prince, too, because he just said excluding Order of the Phoenix.
He's only had a month to read them, though, the sixth one.
He may have spent every waking moment reading the book, you know.
20 times in a month.
It's possible. All right, so let's go around the round table here.
All right, Ben. Let's go alphabetical, Ben. Or Andrew.
Andrew used to be last, okay?
Okay.
Okay, well, I've read the books around 10 times each. And when I first started reading the books back in 8th grade, which had been early 2003 or so, when I first started reading them, I, like, read them all in order. I was really very strict about it. I'd have to go Sorcerer's Stone, Chamber of Secrets, Prisoner of Azkaban, then Goblet of Fire. And then Order of the Phoenix came out 6 months after I started reading the series. And that book I've only read like 4 or 5 times because, I don't know, it's a monster. And it's just hard to find time to read when we all have pretty busy schedules and school and things like that. And Half-Blood Prince, I'm going to confess that I'm a bad boy and I've only read it once. Yeah.
Go ahead and send your
hate mail already. But I think I comprehend a lot when I read, in case you haven't noticed.
Well, it all started for me when I was 6, and
you had a great birthday cake, right?
I was bullied at school. Okay. I had a really tough time at school. You know, I didn't like it at all.
It was a really tough time at school, and Harry Potter took me away from that, so I've read it 50 times.
Before Order of the Phoenix came out, I was reading each one, then the next one, then the third one, then the fourth one, and I suppose, I don't know, probably 5 to 10 times each for those. Then, and after the fifth one came out, I was just reading that one, and then after the sixth one, I was just reading the sixth one and the fifth one. So, I mean, I haven't really gone back to the first four for a while now. For the last two, I've probably read them a few times each, 3 to 5, something like that. But I'm planning to go back and read them all in a row soon.
Okay, I came into Harry Potter through the first movie, so I started reading the second book, and I went from the second to the third, then the fourth, and at that time, that was the day that Goblet of Fire came out on paperback, which was really cool. But then I did them in order, and I think I've read probably the first four books about 3 to 7 times, something like that. I think Prisoner of Azkaban I've probably read the most, and Order of the Phoenix and HBP I've read twice each. Which is actually kind of bad for book 5, but as Ben said, it was a monster.
Okay, and I read each one 3 times each, excluding Half-Blood Prince, which I've only read once. All right, now let's take one more voice.
But you're
again.
A bad boy like me, Andrew. You jerk. You're a
what?
Sorry excuse for a Harry Potter fan.
Oh, yeah, well, you know.
Only reading Half-Blood Prince
once. I read the books once, I mean, I know what goes on.
That's no excuse. Yeah, you okay, anyway, Yeah, do the last voicemail here.
Okay.
Roll the
tape. So here's our featured voicemail of the week. This one comes from Matt. Could this be Matt from Veritas Serum?
Why do you say that? Who cares?
Because I like Matt from Veritas Serum. All right, let's listen.
Hi, MuggleCast guys.
Is that Matt from Brita Serum? Is that Matt from Brita Serum? I don't know.
Is that Matt?
What the heck? I was the number of these wrong.
I met him, and I'm squashing all the rumors that it's not Matt from Brita Serum.
Oh, my God.
Hello, MuggleCast. I think your show is great. If Voldemort was immortal from the Horcruxes, why was he drinking unicorn blood and looking for the Philosopher's Stone in book 1? Thanks.
This is a good question. I think it's about it's got to do with the quality of life. Definitely. If you look in Greek mythology, there's a lot of characters that become immortal, but they have really bad lives. Like there was this one. I'm sorry, and all English scholars and all Greek scholars, please forgive me. I don't know the names to these guys, but there was a story of a mortal who went to the gods and asked to be immortal, and they made him immortal, but he kept aging. And so even though he never died, he aged and withered away into the like nothingness. And then then there's other classic stories of immortality where it's just basically immortality is used to torture people. So really, I think it's got to do with the quality of life, and that's why Voldemort was drinking the unicorn blood, and that's also why he needed feeding from Nagini or Nagina in book 4. I think it's all to do with how strong he is, because even though he's immortal, he only has one of the Horcrux. He's only in possession of the one that occupies his body, and he does,
Good. Yeah. Very good
okay.
point.
Thank
Very
you.
Good point. Okay. What I think is sort of extending on what Eric said is that Voldemort, he didn't want the one Horcrux he had that he was inhabiting right then, that piece of his soul, he didn't want it to die. So he was having Quirrell drink the unicorn blood just to sustain him long enough to try to keep him alive before that Horcrux dies. That was the main issue for him drinking the unicorn blood, is because he needed to stay alive long enough to get the elixir of life, which failed, so that Horcrux, I guess it did stay alive, but once again, he was almost dead, And like what Hagrid said, is that it can save someone even when they're an inch from death, but they're going to lead a cursed life. Like Friend said, that it can save you from death even if you're an inch away, So what happened is he drank the blood just to keep him from dying, and that he didn't really care if he ended up leading a cursed life because he's doomed anyway. So that's just my thought, my take on it.
Couldn't it be that he wasn't actually an inch from death, but he was just hanging on to existing as something worthwhile, because immortality doesn't mean that you have to go on existing forever as a human. You could just have a tiny bit in you that's still existing. So he was sort of past death, but he couldn't die. So it's a kind of catch-22 situation. So the elixir was just there to strengthen him to a form where he'd still be alive, just as he would be if he hadn't drank the elixir, but he'd have more sort of will and energy, so he could start creating all these potions and stuff that would finally, you know, come the fourth book, turn him back into a, well, I say human, but he's not really human, but into that type of form.
Okay, so I think that wraps up MuggleCast Episode 4. Once again, I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Ben Shane.
I'm Jamie Lawrence.
And still talking, I'm Eric Skull. I might as well give into it, really. Give into the criticism and stuff. It's great.
So that's all for this week's edition of MuggleCast. Once again, I'm Andrew Sims, and if you'd like to send us a voicemail, please email voice@staff.mugglenet.com. Also, don't forget, our competition runs through Episode 6, so if you'd like to enter, please send in your one entry to voldemort@staff.mugglenet.com. Also, don't forget, comments, suggestions, or we'd also like to know how you listen to our show. Send those in to mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com. We'll see you next week.
Six. Okay. Six. I
want to. That's it, Eric. Don't say it. Just type it.
Eric's after Eric. Okay. Do not let Eric go before Eric. Okay. That wouldn't be fair. That would not be fair.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Okay. Wait. I think Eric wants to say something.
Come on, guys.